Chapter 5. Free from Ego. Energy and the Spiritual Life. The Tantra is concerned, above all, with energy, an emphasis which offsets, in the most direct way possible, the tendency to view the central concept of the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, that is, voidness or shunyata, as featureless, colourless, and without content. According to the Tantra, the void is alive with unleashed energy. It is attained not when the yogi has thought very hard about it, but when it illuminates the whole of his consciousness. The experience of the void is entirely bright and beautiful, with fully experienced energy, a bright white light containing within itself all the colours of the rainbow. Philosophically, the counterbalance to the abstract teaching on shunyata is the Yogacara view of mind only, which is shared by both Mahayana and Tantric schools of Buddhism, and open to being understood at a merely philosophical level. In the end, any philosophy can lose touch with its practical applications, and it is at the level of specific practices that we find the main difference from the Vajrayana point of view, between the Vajrayana and the Mahayana teachings. The Vajrayana is concerned with transforming the entire psychophysical organism, with refining, manipulating, and redirecting its mental and physical energies into increasingly subtle, concentrated, and refined states. The Vajrayana concretizes the highest teachings of the Dharma in a direct experience of the body. But its conception of the body does not stop with the material substratum of physical experience. The Tantric practitioner works with the subtle body, which resembles the physical body in every respect, except that it is mind-formed rather than simply an animated material form. Experienced at this level, the body manifests not as matter, but as energy. The avowed goal of the Vajrayana is the direct experience of one's own essential nature, and the work of the Tantra is to bring this about through a radical transformation of energy. To begin this process, one's energies must be activated, indeed decisively stirred up, from their sleeping, earthbound state. The significant moment at which these energies are roused is the point of initiation, or what is sometimes referred to as tantric empowerment. My friend Yogi Chen, a Chan and Vajrayana master, whom I visited quite regularly when I lived in Kalimpong in the 1950s, used to make the point that, although one might realize certain truths at a deeper than intellectual level by means of Mahayana meditation, such realization remained essentially mental and emotional. It did not involve the whole being. It did not incorporate all one's energies. According to him, it was the specific function of the Tantra to bring even one's physical energies into that higher spiritual realization, to transform the body as well as the intellect and the emotions. There is nothing really revolutionary about this tantric perspective. Throughout the Buddhist tradition, including the Theravada, it is emphasized that the experience of meditation is of the body as well as the mind. In the Samyutta Nikaya of the Pali Canon, for example, we find the following account of the Buddha's meditative powers. When Ananda, the Tathagata, immerses the body in the mind, and the mind in the body, and when he dwells having entered upon a blissful perception, and a buoyant perception, in regard to the body, on that occasion, the body of the Tathagata rises up without difficulty from the earth into the air. he wields the various kinds of spiritual power. Having been one, he becomes many. Having been many, he becomes one. He exercises mastery with the body as far as the Brahma world. The Pali texts are, therefore, no more in favour of a bloodless and disembodied practice than are the Tantras. In all Buddhist traditions, the spiritual has to be incorporated. However, practitioners of the Vajrayana placed particular emphasis on this aspect of spiritual practice, primarily through teachings known as the Inner Yogas. These are based on an understanding of the body that differs radically from modern Western notions of the physical. In the Inner Yogas, one works to transform the subtle energies of the illusory body, as it is called, which closely follows the physical structure of the human organism. By means of a system similar to that of the ancient Indian Tantra, the Vajrayana maps out the illusory body in a network of energy channels and energy centres that corresponds to certain areas of the gross physical body. This is what Milarepa is referring to when he sings, in the first song of this episode, of his mastery of the practice of manipulating the nadis, prana and bindu. Prana, sometimes referred to as breath, refers to these psychophysical energies, while bindu refers specifically to masculine sexual energy. Nadi, sometimes translated as vein, means something more like nerve, though not in the sense of the term as it applies to the ordinary nervous system. The nadis are something more like a subtle network of vital forces. Different texts say different things about the subtle body, but the Tibetan tradition presents it as a subtle counterpart of the physical body, and as coextensive with it. According to the Tantra, the nerves of the subtle body correspond with the median nerve running down the physical spine. On the left of the spinal column is the Lalana, coloured white and corresponding to the moon and to water, while on the right is the Rasana, which is red and corresponds to the sun and to fire. Tantric practice consists in bringing the breath, prana, into what is known as the central channel, the avaduti, or subtle median nerve. This involves mobilizing the various bodily and mental forces and channeling them through one or other of the centers of psychophysical energy, known as chakras, that lie along this subtle median nerve. The result is the liberation of these forces as they are brought together into a consciously experienced single flow of subtle energy. There are said to be seven chakras in all. The lowest chakra, the Muladhara, is at the perineum. The second is a few fingers' breadth below the navel. The third at the navel. The fourth at the heart. The fifth at the throat. The sixth between the eyebrows. And the seventh at the crown of the head. The Tantra symbolizes the chakras in the form of lotus flowers of various numbers of petals, the thousand-petaled lotus being the topmost. In this way, these solar and lunar energies are brought together in an ever more subtle yet increasingly concentrated synthesis. Reason combines with emotion, meditation combines with action in the world, and working on one's own development combines with working for the welfare of others. Wisdom and compassion are unified in the direct experience of reality, free from any obstruction or delusion. The method of the Tantra is based on the idea of correspondence between higher and lower manifestations of energy, familiar in the West from the old axiom of European alchemy, as above, so below. The tantric sage's engagement with the elemental nature of the material universe is intimately involved with the transformation of consciousness, the inner world of the mind. For example, certain of the chakras are associated with one or another of the elements, earth, water, fire, air, and space. The degree of refinement of the material elements relative to one another corresponds to the various degrees of integration and refinement of consciousness, or psychophysical energy, achieved through the opening of different chakras. Enlightenment is dependent on energy being totally available on all levels, and within the Tantra, this becomes the main focus of one's practice. Nor is this an exercise in abstract wish fulfillment. It is worked out in the concrete details of everyday existence. If there are energies that are not going along with what you are essentially trying to do, even though they may not actively hold you back, they will, nonetheless, tend to sit like a dead weight on the energies that are actively trying to take you forward. The Tantra is designed to address this fundamental problem of the spiritual life, that you can make quite a lot of effort and still get nowhere. Liberation is essentially about liberating energies, which means experiencing them more fully. One of the ways we repress energy or lock it away is in habitual patterns of thought, feeling, and behavior. If Buddhism is concerned with bringing about the direct experience of oneself in the very depths of one's being, it does so by bringing into consciousness this submerged energy of which we are usually unaware. This is easier said than done. Ideally, you want to get rid of the negativity, but retain the energy tied up within it. There is a lot of energy in anger, for example. You might even say that anger is energy, crude energy. And you can't afford to throw it away simply because it is tainted with ill will. Unfortunately, this is what often happens. The energy is thrown away with the negativity, which is perhaps why so many religious men and women, although they are good people, seem rather weak and bloodless and incapable of saying boo to a goose. It would seem that in order to purge themselves of what they see as their human weakness and wickedness, they have also repressed their energy. This inevitably sets up further trouble later on. It is notable that people who could never be described as good often have a lot of zest for life, which makes them a lot of fun to be with. This is a major theme in the work of the poet and painter William Blake. His thesis is that we identify goodness with the faculty of reason that restrains energy, and the forces of evil with the energy that needs to be restrained. In The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which is where this aspect of his ideas is most clearly to the fore, he asserts that, quote, "the tigers of wrath are wiser than the horses of instruction," unquote. That is, energy itself is good, and it is only the curbing of energy that is truly negative. In a note to this work, he remarks, quote, "the reason Milton wrote in fetters when he wrote of angels and God, and at liberty when of devils and hell, is because he was a true poet and of the devil's party without knowing it." This is not to say that if you have lots of energy you are bound to be wicked. Your energy should be accepted as essentially positive, even if you may need to change how you express them. Energy can always be transformed. But if you clamp down on energy generally, positive energies like joy don't get the opportunity to arise at all, because they are locked in along with more negative energies, and the only outcome will be frustration. It's important to bear in mind that truly positive energy, whether one's own or someone else's, is often more difficult to deal with than negative energy. You know where you are with negative energy, whether you indulge it, clamp down on it, or react to it. But what do you do with joy, for example? It doesn't follow the comfortable cycle of unconscious reactivity, that is, the experience of negative emotions. If we are to reclaim and integrate all our energies in the tantric spirit, we have first to happily accept our cruder energies, however muddied they are with old, unhelpful karmic patterns, as the raw material of life. One good way of working with turbulent, difficult, and uncomfortable energies, and of keeping energy flowing while dissolving the negativity in it, is to chant mantras. You could do some mantra chanting to dissolve anger, for example, using the practice to coax energy out of the angry emotion and release it in the form of the chanting voice. However, one of the dangers of what could be called a pseudo-tantric approach is that, on the pretext of transforming negativity, you end up, consciously or otherwise, using the practice to indulge negativity. In the case of chanting, you would need to be careful that you were truly transforming the energy and not simply transferring the negativity into the tone and quality of your chanting. You might find yourself chanting the mantra with an oppressive, constraining energy that not only reinforces your angry mood, but communicates it to whoever else is present. One has to be receptive to the positive content of the mantra, putting the energy of one's negativity into the chanting, not the negativity itself, and always looking for a brighter, lighter, and more vital energy to come through. For the tantra, energy is primary, and one's ethical practice needs to be configured to take this into account. It is not enough simply to hold back from unskillful action. While unskillful action is always unskillful, holding back energy is unskillful too. From a tantric perspective, if you don't put as much energy as you can into whatever you are doing, it isn't really worth bothering to do it. According to tantric ethics, it is unskillful to block energy, whether your own or someone else's, and unskillful to misappropriate or exploit energy, misuse or abuse it, subvert or misdirect it, pollute or muddy it. It is clearly difficult psychologically to offer something to someone who doesn't want or need the thing you're offering. Having turned down the horse, Milarepa is certainly not going to need spurs or boots. But the young man is not put off and offers his boots anyway. They are evidently the best that money can buy, made from elk, wild yak, and crocodile skin, embroidered with silk and decorated with brass spurs. He knows that the tantra involves making offerings, and he is certainly doing the right thing in making them. Moreover, he prefaces his offering by correctly observing that there is no attachment in your heart. Having made that observation, however, he seems to challenge Milarepa to prove it, suggesting that Milarepa may need boots to protect him from dogs with sharp teeth, brambles, and so on. It is as if he is trying to sell the boots to Milarepa, to tickle his fancy, to awaken in him a sense of dissatisfaction with a life without boots. Finally, however, he reverts to an attitude of personal sacrifice, of giving up something in which he invests his identity, and he concludes by asking for Milarepa's compassionate blessing. Even so, Milarepa refuses the offering. What Milarepa needs is what he already has, the inner boots of renunciation and mindfulness. The point he makes in the song is essentially the same as in the previous one. But what he says here is strangely reminiscent of an image from a work called the Bodhicharya Avatara by the 8th century Indian Mahayana poet Shantideva. In a verse from that work, Shantideva points out that in order to protect your feet, you could try to cover the whole earth in leather, or, more economically, you could fit two small pieces of leather to your feet and get the same protection. He says that while most of us choose the sensible option in this respect by wearing shoes, we fail to protect ourselves against enemies by recourse to the same principle. You can gird yourself to kill your enemies whenever they try to prevent you from getting what you want. But this is a ridiculous policy when there is the alternative of practicing the metta bhavana, the meditation through which one develops loving-kindness. In the cultivation of love for all that lives, you can protect yourself from thoughts of enmity arising in the first place. If there is a need to weigh the concern to protect one's body from without against the concern to protect the mind from within, Milarepa is very clear about which he thinks is more important. Indeed, the kind of external situations in which a pair of stout boots provide protection have become so unimportant to him that they can be appropriated as metaphoric features of his inner landscape. For instance, craving meadow, jealous swamp, and the land of darkness and blind views. The dog of hate and the steep hill of pride are also to be avoided. All these names seem to anticipate, in a curious way, the language of John Bunyan's 17th century classic of nonconformist spirituality, The Pilgrim's Progress, with its Slough of Despond, Valley of Humiliation, and Doubting Castle. This song uses the same potent metaphor of the inner life as a journey towards a distant goal. Obviously, the features of the spiritual landscape are produced by the mind of the individual negotiating them, and they keep reappearing over and over again, so the journey is daunting to say the least. So what kind of footwear is required for such frustrating terrain? The answer is plain. There is no point in slipping your feet into something stylish or cosy. You need tough boots. They will hurt a bit to begin with, but they will last and give you protection and a sure grip in whatever terrain you encounter. Milarepa. I cut my boots from the hide of the renunciation of samsara, and with the leather of awakening from transiency and delusion. I made my boots with the craftsmanship of deep faith in karma, with the dye of non-clinging to the myriad forms, and with the thread and rope of devotion. To give up the untrustworthy protection offered by self-interest, to awaken to absolute insecurity, to accept that your unskillful actions of the past will have unforeseen consequences, these are the hard tasks of the spiritual life. But at some point, one has to put these boots on. Devotion is, of course, the function of binding oneself to one's ideals with vows of dedication, so it is appropriately compared with bootlaces. Buddhist practice is here presented as a source of protection which allows the practitioner to go unscathed through the world. It is quite a common conception, found also in the idea of the armour of Shunyata, and even the image that traditionally illustrates the fourth level of meditative concentration, or dhyana, which is likened to a man who emerges from a pool on a hot day and wraps himself from head to foot in a white sheet. The Bible uses the same language in expressions such as the whole armour of God and the shield of faith. Positive mental states are the best protection, not only against the vicissitudes of material existence, but more importantly, against one's own tendency towards ego-centred thought and activity. Milarepa, these are my boots, the boots of a yogi. These boots are what enable Milarepa to navigate Craving Meadow, to scale the steep hill of pride, and, one presumes, to resist the biting teeth of the dog of hate. However, Milarepa's primary aim here, getting rid of ego clinging, should not be confused with a kind of feeble self-effacement. It does not invite us to throw a wet blanket of self-admonishment over any feeling of pleasure at having done something well, with the thought, oh dear, that's my ego. A friend of mine from my very early days back in England in the 1960s used to write me long letters every few months with lots of good advice, and she would constantly undercut any trace of self-assertion by apologising for her ego. She would write, I was sorry not to hear from you from such a long time, but that's just my ego. Or, I felt quite pleased when someone came to see me and said how nice my paintings were, but of course that's just my ego. When one trips over oneself at every step in this way, I'm afraid it is just the ego saying, that's just my ego, probably as an automatic ploy to forestall criticism. It is an inverted form of conceit, dressed up as non-ego. What one is apologising for may well be not one's ego at all. So one should not be too ego-conscious in this sense. In fact, the Tantra, and the Mahayana generally, is careful to identify a positive form of pride, which it calls Buddha pride. It is unconnected with ego clinging and starts with an honest satisfaction with what one is doing. In traditional texts, the practitioner is encouraged to reflect, having taken the Bodhisattva vow, I belong to the family of the Buddha, which I must never disgrace. How can I consider committing an unskillful act that might bring shame to that name? We need not be thinking in terms of the Bodhisattva ideal to apply this to our own lives. If, for example, you are going to cook a meal for your friends, and you want to do it to the best of your ability, your ego-centred motivation would be to prove that you are better than others, to win appreciation and acknowledgement of your efforts and skill. But a positive Buddha pride attitude would be, how could I even think of neglecting to do this as skillfully as I can? Not to give them my best would be unworthy of the ideal to which I have committed myself and of the regard I have for my friends. Indeed, it is a matter of pride to prepare the meal with metta as well as skill. Otherwise, I would be letting myself down, letting my friends down, and letting the Buddha down. This is the kind of healthy self-respect of which the youth is eminently capable, given the straightforwardness of his general approach to life. But as yet, he has not been able to transform his worldly self-respect into genuine Buddha pride. He remains oblivious to the momentous shift in attitude that he will have to make if he is to become Milarepa's disciple. The young man addresses Milarepa now as a teacher. Precious and accomplished guru, freed from ego clinging. Evoking the bleak hardship of Milarepa's wanderings, he offers his jacket against the cold, and again the offering is clearly of the highest quality. Being freed from ego clinging, Milarepa is not likely to appreciate owning such a covetable garment, but this does not stop the young man from describing it in meticulous detail, from its lining and silk facings to its lynx fur trim and its collar and hem made of otter skin. However, Milarepa refuses to acknowledge the claims to his attention of passing bodily discomfort when he has much more crucial matters to address. He puts up with material hardship to sharpen his concentration on the real issue. The teaching here is about ethical practice. Milarepa. O'er the cities of the six realms in samsara, with fury blows the evil karmic wind. Driven by the senses and deprived of freedom, one wanders between life and death, roving in bardo. For my part, I aspire to the realm of reality, and adorn the cloth of pure mind and heart with the embroidery of immaculate discipline. Mindfulness is the tailor. In this powerful song, Milarepa presents the essence of our predicament in any of the six realms of conditioned existence, whether as gods or demons, animals or human beings. In any mundane situation where we are in some kind of bardo, that is, an intermediate state. The word bardo is most often used to refer to the state between death and rebirth, but there are other bardos too, including the bardo of the dream state, the bardo of meditation, and the bardo of everyday life. When we are in a dream, it seems entirely real. It is usually only when we wake up from it that we understand we have been dreaming. Similarly, to one who is enlightened and has woken up to the reality of things, everyday life will appear as it really is, transient, and subject to ever-changing conditions. In other words, a bardo. Seeing ordinary life as an intermediate state reminds us that we are involved in something we do not fully understand. We do not see the whole picture, although our worldly habits of mind conspire to hide this reality from us. Wandering the bardo in our confusion, we are buffeted, as Milarepa says, by the furious winds of evil karma, that is, by the effects of our past moral mistakes. We are usually not aware that our actions of body, speech and mind will have ramifications in terms of our future experience. Hence the need to remember, to be mindful. And Milarepa produces a telling image of mindfulness as the tailor who puts the garment of our practice together. Milarepa also offers here a neat reversal of what may be our usual way of thinking. We might normally regard ethics as a worthy but dull base material which we can embroider with more colourful practices. But Milarepa adorns the cloth of samadhi or meditation with the embroidery of sila or ethics. Seen as embroidery, the practice of ethics becomes a matter of delicate and sensitive craftsmanship, the delightful flowering of one's practice rather than just its roots. Milarepa's is an advanced practice of ethical discipline, which in the Kagyu tradition is sometimes understood to follow three stages of development. At the first stage, you are able to work effectively at behaving skillfully and cultivating positive mental states given the right supportive conditions around you, or at least regular contact with others who are practicing in the same way. The second stage of ethical development is the maintenance of the purity of your practice, even among people whose beliefs and habits are in opposition to your values and principles and way of life, perhaps even people living evil lives. To continue to practice effectively in a hostile environment represents a higher level of development. You are like a lotus flower growing from the mud. With the third level, which Milarepa has reached, you are not only able to practice effectively under adverse conditions, you are unaffected by them. Samsara and Nirvana, the state of worldly life and the state of enlightenment, are not separate, although they appear so to the unenlightened mind. With the realization of the true nature of mind, you understand that both are the products of human consciousness, and you are not personally attached to any one form of human consciousness over another. All forms are void. It is a fundamental Buddhist teaching that things have no svabhava, no own being, no ultimate, individual, unchanging essence. Everything is fluid, unfixed, open. So does enlightenment take you beyond the working out of karma altogether? Having gone beyond conceptions of self and other, pleasure and pain, good and evil, do you no longer separate out cause and effect as absolute distinctions, and do you therefore no longer recognize and respect the operation of karma? The enlightened mind sees the conditioned and the unconditioned as non-dual, that is, as an unreal distinction. But this distinction must be very real and clear for those of us who have not transcended it, if we are to have any chance of doing so. If we are going to think of changing our present state, if we have any notion of making progress, we have to discriminate between suffering and joy, confusion and clarity, fear and confidence, self and other, samsara and nirvana. If you are enlightened and therefore above duality, you still see that skillful actions on the mundane level produce happiness, and unskillful actions produce pain. In other words, your realization of shunyata does not cancel out your respect for the law of conditionality as it operates on the mundane level. So an enlightened being does not ignore the law of cause and effect. In fact, one aspect of enlightenment is the ability to see it with absolute clarity. Absolute truth does not negate relative truth on the level at which relative truth operates. There is a famous Zen story that illustrates the danger of misunderstanding this aspect of enlightenment. It concerns a so-called spirit fox, a sort of haunted or spirit-possessed fox. A monk eventually exorcises this creature and then asks him how he came to be a spirit fox. It seems that the spirit fox was originally a Zen master, and that he became a spirit fox as a result of his wrong answer to an apparently simple question. The question was, what becomes of the law of karma when you become enlightened? And the answer he gave was, when you become enlightened, you go beyond the law of karma. For that terrible mistake, he had been reborn as a spirit fox for 500 rebirths. So he asks the monk what he should have said. What you should have said, the monk replies, is that when you become enlightened, you do not get in the way of the law of karma. Milarepa. I brighten the shoulder padding with the great light which shines at the time of death. I cut the hem of bardo enlightenment to the measurement of pure magic bodies. Finally, Milarepa introduces the theme of gaining enlightenment in the bardo state between death and rebirth. When released from the physical body with which it has identified itself throughout life, the mind has a brief opportunity to realize its true nature. If you realize the clear light in the intermediate state after death, you become enlightened, and in doing so you realize the pure magic bodies. Here Milarepa is referring to a complex doctrine which was developed in the Buddhist tradition over many centuries. There is much that could be said about it, but in this context we will just try to get a basic sense of what he means by magic bodies. The tantric conception of enlightenment is based on the perception that, to be any kind of being, even an enlightened one, you always have to be embodied in some way. If there is no ultimate duality between conditioned and unconditioned, an enlightened mind must always come with an enlightened body. The question is, what kind of body? The figure of the Buddha presents Buddhism with a paradox. The Buddha was a human being, albeit an enlightened one, who lived at a certain time and place. But he was much more than that. The Buddha is the manifestation in time and space of something that is beyond personality, beyond time and space, certainly beyond any conceptual designation on the part of the unenlightened dualistic mind. A distinction, therefore, emerged in the early days of Buddhism between the physical body of the historical Buddha and the non-dual enlightened state from which his teaching emanated. References in the Pali Canon to the Dharmakaya indicate that the early understanding of this body of truth was that it was the totality of the truths taught by the Buddha. However, as the Buddhist tradition developed into the Mahayana, the conception of the Dharmakaya began to be understood in metaphysical terms rather than simply in doctrinal terms, and the body of truth came to be regarded as identical with reality itself in all its non-dual formlessness. It is in the later phases of the Mahayana, particularly in the Yogacara, that we find a third conception of the Buddha, a third body, which is neither abstract and beyond thought nor concretely historical. This is the Sambhogakaya, literally body of mutual enjoyment, the archetypal Buddha or Bodhisattva, the ideal being. This, rather than the conception of the Buddha as a historical personality, came to be the focal point of the Mahayana sutras. The Sambhogakaya inhabits the vast reaches of time and space in a way that renders the Buddha ever-present, always accessible. The physical body of the enlightened mind, meanwhile, came to be known as the Nirmanakaya, or created body. These, then, are the three Buddha bodies. First, there is the Dharmakaya, the body of truth, of ultimate reality. Secondly, there is what became known as the Nirmanakaya, the historical flesh and blood Buddha, a created body, or magic body, as Milarepa calls it. And thirdly, forming a bridge between the historical and the literally inconceivable, we find the Sambhogakaya, the archetypal embodiment, which manifests in the forms of Buddha and Bodhisattva figures. These figures represent the ideal of the Buddha, considered in the most elevated terms of myth and symbol, and are the basis of the visualization practices of the Vajrayana. It must be emphasized that the Trikaya, the three Buddha bodies, are not to be understood as being separate from each other, although the translation of kaya as body, being somewhat over-literal, doesn't really help us to understand this. The three bodies do not stand side by side or on top of each other. They are more like different dimensions of the Buddha nature. Penetrate deeply into the historical Buddha, and you encounter the Sambhogakaya. Penetrate more deeply still, and you reach the Dharmakaya. Another way of thinking of the Trikaya doctrine is that it represents enlightenment as the transformation of all aspects of being, the three kayas of the Buddha corresponding on the transcendental level to body, speech and mind on the mundane level. The task of the guru is to make the truth manifest in the disciple throughout his or her whole being by initiating and instructing him or her in a tantric sadhana. The ensuing enlightenment is said to consist in the transformation of one's body into Nirmanakaya, one's speech into Sambhogakaya, and one's mind or heart into Dharmakaya. According to the Tantra, this transformation is a fuller, richer, more complex realization than the kind of insight accessible to non-tantric Buddhists. For the Vajrayana, the route to the Dharmakaya is through a direct encounter with the Sambhogakaya, the archetypal realm. This is the basis of the visualization practices of the tantric path. One goes for refuge to one's yidam, the archetypal Buddha or Bodhisattva, to whom one is introduced at the moment of tantric initiation. The visualization practices of the Vajrayana are based on the pragmatic understanding that the Sambhogakaya is as far ahead as we can see. Whatever lies beyond that must be left alone for the time being. In any effort to understand the images, myths and symbols of the Vajrayana, we are inevitably held back by our natural tendency to literal-mindedness. The imagination is of far greater use in this context than the ordinary rational mind, because the reality represented by the Sambhogakaya and manifested in the form of archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is accessible only by means of a visionary faculty. But what is required here is more than just imagination, in the sense of an ability to build up images in the mind, or even a creative artistic faculty. Whatever mental images one creates must be infused with at least some sense of the Buddha's teaching that the true nature of conditioned things, including visionary experience, is impermanent and provisional. This meditative visionary faculty is not above the imagination, it is another dimension of imagination. It's imagination with a capital I. It is essentially the same faculty. From another point of view, one can also say that the formless is not necessarily closer to reality than that which has form. One could say that the Dharmakaya is Buddhahood without form, the Sambhogakaya is Buddhahood with form, and the two are non-different. In fact, insight can be developed with regard to any conditioned object, even through contemplation of a matchbox, if that matchbox is experienced as conditioned and empty of inherent existence. Realizing that, because it came into existence, it must therefore go out of existence, and that all apparent things are like this, you can develop insight. The reason we are not likely to develop insight through contemplating a matchbox is simply that we are not likely to have very strong feelings about that particular object, so it would be hard for us to concentrate on it very powerfully. However, if you have an experience of the Sambhogakaya, a vision of a realm of archetypal forms, if you actually see a bodhisattva, all your most refined emotional energies will be aroused and unified behind your contemplation of the aspect of reality that the figure symbolizes, and this may catapult you into insight. One could think of the Nirmanakaya and the Sambhogakaya as two veils hung before the Dharmakaya, understood as reality in its pristine, unmediated form. The Sambhogakaya veil is thinner, more diaphanous, and perhaps more brightly coloured than the Nirmanakaya veil, but through both, whether through the personality of the historical Buddha or through the brilliant form of a visualised Buddha or Bodhisattva, the transcendental may be glimpsed. famously some contemporaries of the historical Buddha, although they met and talked to him, had no idea of the transcendental reality he represented. Likewise, one can have a purely visual experience of a Buddha or Bodhisattva without any sense of that figure's true significance. In other words, it is quite possible to see either the Nyingmakaya or Sambhogakaya at face value, oblivious to the Dharmakaya shining through. But to allow these forms to take us closer to an experience of the unconditioned nature of pure reality, we need not consciously strive to read significance in them or explain them in words. They can be left to speak for themselves, to have their own effect upon us. We just have to be receptive to them. Nothing if not persistent, the young man continues his guide to medieval Tibetan men's tailoring. Over his reddish-green jacket, he is wearing a coat in grey-green wool, hemmed with maroon fur, and this too he offers to Milarepa, who declares that, like all the other offerings, it is surplus to his requirements. Milarepa. With the cloth of Arshe, vital heat, is the lapel of four chakras made. My tailor is the inner prana mind, who warms teaked lay and makes it flow. The merged bliss-void experience is the needle used for sewing. Milarepa's theme in the song with which he refuses this gift is tummo, psychic heat, a practice that assumed a great importance in the Vajrayana traditions. Like the meditation on the bindu and the nadis, the tummo practice works by means of special breathing practices and yogic postures, designed to bring one's energies to an intense pitch of concentration. One then begins various visualizations of the inner fire, and these are said to have certain physical effects, in particular that of raising the body temperature regardless of external conditions. This is how Milarepa, the cotton-clad yogi, could withstand the bitter cold of his mountain hermitage. Tummo is the so-called cloth that keeps him warm. This effect is a well-attested phenomenon associated with meditative concentration. You naturally generate physical heat when you meditate, heat that others can feel. It can sometimes even seem as though you have a feverishly high temperature, except that you feel not ill, but happy and comfortable. Some yogis make a particular practice out of this experience of tummo. However, the idea of psychic heat should not be taken only on a literal level. The pleasurable experience of heat in the body is the psychophysical counterpart of the intense bliss which, according to the Tantra, has to be conjoined with a mental apprehension or intuition of voidness in the non-dual samadhi state. Bliss and emptiness are complementary aspects of what is actually a single experience. We find the same idea expressed in the traditional Mahayana notion of enlightenment as the supreme union of samadhi and prajna, of transcendental insight and supremely positive emotion. The Tantra simply emphasizes, in more concrete terms, that these two factors must always go together. The void is not just a clear mental experience, and tummo is not just a warm physical experience. They come together in an experience of intense bliss. The idea that enlightenment is blissful may seem to be in clear contrast to the cool, emotionally astringent nirvana which Theravadin Buddhism is popularly supposed to envisage. In fact, though, the blissful element of nirvana is emphasized throughout the Buddhist tradition. After all, the well-known expression, Nibbanam Paraman Sukham, Nirvana is the highest bliss, comes directly from the Dhammapada of the Pali Canon. In deep states of meditation, the vital energies of the body become concentrated in an experience of profound stability. This process of the intensification of bodily energy and emotional and cognitive clarity can be traced in the formulation known as the Seven Factors of Enlightenment, or Bodhiyangas, which is found throughout the Pali Canon. As one's bodily energies become increasingly concentrated and refined, they are transformed via the state of priti, or rapture, into sukha, or serene joy. The vital energy remains, but it is integrated into a succession of increasingly positive mental states, and consciousness becomes permeated with a blissful lightness and energy. The producing of inner warmth then becomes contentment or emotional positivity, a radiance that is not stimulated by some external source, but comes from our own spiritual resources. Wisdom's diamond-like clarity is utterly suffused with the blissful heat of inwardly generated well-being and contentment. The bliss gives content to the experience of voidness, while the voidness gives clarity to the experience of bliss. So you experience blissful inner heat and at the same time the illuminating void, like fire and ice together. The four higher chakras are made of this vital heat. In other words, the Tummo practice of Chandali Yoga involves heating the Bindu or Tig Lei. This is a reference, literally speaking, to semen, but we can also take it to mean energy in its grosser form, which is gradually sublimated and made more and more subtle and refined. The inner prana mind warms this energy and causes it to flow. In the course of being heated, the energy becomes sublimated and refined and rises up, guided by the inner prana mind, through the median nerve to awaken the four major psychic centers, or chakras, of the heart, the throat, the third eye, and the crown of the head. This process is guided by cognitive insight into the clear void of shunyata, which engages all the vital energies in the form of a steadily intensifying bliss, finally to unite them with that clear experience of the void. To put it another way, the process of gathering one's energies is inherently and increasingly blissful, until that bliss is so intense that it unites with the clear void. And at this point, the inborn vital heat manifests. Milarepa. The cloth is inborn vital heat. Now summer and winter are for me the same. When Milarepa says that summer and winter are the same for him, he means not only that he is impervious to extremes of climate, but that he has gone beyond all distinctions. This is the inborn vital heat, Sahajiha, or inherent Buddha nature. It is a transcendental heat which is conterminous with reality. It is not artificially produced, it needs only to be released. It is there from the beginning. The young man's next song follows the usual pattern of salutation and praise of Milarepa's non-attachment, followed by a solicitous but facile conjecture as to his material needs, and an offering of something that will supposedly meet them. He seems not to have heard what Milarepa has been saying about his practice of Tummo, because he surmises that, quote, you must sometimes feel the cold, unquote. He therefore offers his hat, a heady confection of crocodile hide, vulture skin, and gaudy feathers, around an intricate frame of precious metal. He recommends it to Milarepa not on aesthetic or practical grounds, but on account of its exchange value, which is apparently that of a big yak. Rather than asking for some kind of blessing in return, he makes his first commitment. In summer and in winter, I will follow and pay homage to you. Milarepa tells him not to be too rash, to keep his hat and his head. My dear young man, do not lose your head. Milarepa is no longer at the mercy of the elements. Just as he has no fear of water, he says, I fear not the element of air within, nor do I depend on falcon's flesh. I feel gay and joyous in a biting wind. He has no need for wealth, nor does he need a hat, as the crown of his head is already occupied by his guru, Marpa, visualized above his head as part of the practice of guru yoga. The guru yoga differs from lineage to lineage, but it usually begins with imagining your guru above your head. Then you go on to imagine your guru's guru above his head, and that guru's guru in turn above his head, and so on, through the whole lineage. Next, you imagine the blessing of the gurus coming down through the lineage to you. And then you feel your mind united with your guru's mind, and his mind united with his own guru's mind, going back in this way to the Buddha, the original transcendental source of inspiration, usually visualized not as the historical Buddha Shakyamuni, but in an archetypal or Sambhogakaya form, perhaps Vajradhara or Amitabha. As a devoted disciple, you are supposed to be aware of your guru above your head all the time. This is because, according to the Vajrayana, the guru does not just stand for the Buddha, but is the Buddha, at least insofar as the individual disciple is concerned. The guru is the master who helps you to transform your crude, mundane body, speech and mind into the unconditioned body, speech and mind of a Buddha. Consequently, you see your guru not only as the Dharmakaya, the embodiment of the ultimate truth or ultimate reality, but also as the Sambhogakaya, the manifestation of Buddhahood in time and space. The exercise is a simple matter of cultivating, experiencing, and expressing gratitude. Gratitude opens us up to the fact of our interconnectedness with others. Whenever we enjoy or achieve something, it is salutary to recognize and acknowledge the work and kindness of all the individuals who have contributed to it. But gratitude to the guru has an extra dimension, because what we are grateful for is beyond valuation. There is no hope of repaying the debt except by passing the gift on to others. Another way of looking at this is to say that gratitude is a way of opening ourselves up to the merit accrued by the guru, which becomes inextricably linked with our own as he passes it freely on to us. The guru yoga is a formal version of something that should happen anyway in the spiritual life. We should all be grateful to whoever it was who first introduced us to the Dharma. There is a very famous example of this. The Buddha's most eminent disciple, Shariputra, made a point of prostrating in gratitude every day of his life to Asaji, the disciple who gave him his first contact with the Dharma. Although Sariputra quickly outstripped Asaji in spiritual attainment, enlightened as he was, he continued to prostrate himself to the still unenlightened Asaji. Milarepa. He is the wish-fulfilling gem, Buddha's transformation body. If you see him with the eye of veneration, you will find he is the Buddha, Dorje Chang. The Guru is the manifestation in the present time of the current of spiritual energy that has come down from the Buddha through the lineage of one's own tradition. The lineage, or line of transmission, is like a spiritual chain reaction. It's not the actual handing down of an object or thing. Even though the idea of transmission suggests that the disciple gains something which he or she did not previously have, the role of the guru is primarily to activate the disciple's energies. He, or sometimes she, enables the disciple to tap the vast source of inspiration and energy that lies hidden and unconscious in their own being. Nor does transmission consist in a certificated process whereby a kind of spiritual management role is passed on from one generation to another. For one thing, a guru may have had many teachers, and all the transmissions he has received through all of them are focused through him on the disciple. The lineage is not a sort of spiritual family tree that the interested disciple might like to trace back to the Buddha. It represents a direct experience of awakening, a living truth that has been stimulated again and again through the guru-disciple relationship. Dorje Chang is the Buddha Vajradhara, or bearer of the Vajra. He is depicted with a Vajra standing upright in his palm, the Vajra being a symbol of ultimate reality, and sometimes a Vajra bell as well, and he is considered to be the primordial originator of the whole Kagyu lineage, and thus their Adiguru or Adi Buddha. The term Adi means primordial, in other words, from the beginning. But Vajradhara is the primordial guru or Buddha, not in the sense of initiating the lineage in time, or even at the beginning of time. He symbolizes its origin as being outside time altogether, as being transcendental, and in that sense without origin. Thus, Adi really means without origin, and the Adi Buddha symbolizes the timeless nature of enlightenment or Buddhahood. Buddhahood, in its essence, has no beginning. It cannot be said to arise because it is always there. It represents a dimension beyond time, into which you break through on the attainment of enlightenment, at which point you realize that you have always been there. The youth next offers his most treasured possession, quote, this white, translucent, six-edged jade. The youth is evidently quite well off. It should not be assumed, however, that these offerings are what he just happens to have about his person at the time. They almost certainly constitute most of his wealth. This is characteristic of traditional pre-industrial societies, particularly nomadic cultures, such as those of medieval Mongolia and Tibet. Your wealth is not kept in the bank, or in stocks and shares, or even in bars of gold under the bed. It is in your hat, your coat, your horse, your sword. You wear it, or your wife wears it in the form of gold ornaments. The womenfolk of nomadic tribal societies are like walking banks. In time of need, they can sell a gold ring or a bangle. As a young man points out, with this jade, you can never be poor. Of course, farmers and peasants hold their wealth in land and cattle, but the nobility traditionally carry their fortunes in the form of personal adornment. Even in England, as recently as the reign of Elizabeth I, young men would come to London from the country, having sold large tracts of land, in order to appear at court dressed in fabulously expensive clothes of silk and jewel-encrusted satin, hoping to catch the Queen's eye and win preferment. They were, it was said, wearing their estates on their backs. A sensible young man would invest a great deal of money in a gold hilt for his sword or jewelled feather for his cap, in the hope of a good return in terms of advancement to fame and fortune, power and prosperity. Tibetans who have not been urbanized and modernized still maintain this sort of attitude to anything they wear or carry. A nomad from the far-flung valleys of the Tibetan plateau would never think of wearing something fake or artificial if he could avoid it, especially on a trip to Lhasa or on pilgrimage. He would be sure to wear real gold, real jewels, quality leather and cloth. As usual, the young man prefaces his offering with a statement of faith in Milarepa, particularly in his non-attachment. He is able to acknowledge that there is no point in trying to seduce or buy Milarepa with his gift. But it is as if he has still not really taken in what he understands in theory. He cannot help pointing out that with this jade, Milarepa can never be poor, so his lack of insight betrays itself. Moreover, having offered his most precious possession, he can't help asking for a teaching instead of just a blessing. There is an unspoken assumption that the value of the offering calls for an equivalent spiritual reward. But Milarepa is still not prepared to accept the implication that he himself has any need or desire for anything. He replies according to the terms in which the offering has been made. Milarepa, there is no end to human greed. Even with hoarded wealth head high, one cannot reach contentment. I do not envy you your wealth and goods. The greatest treasure is contentment in my heart. The teaching of the whispered lineage is my wealth. Here, Milarepa's teaching is completely continuous, in principle, with that of the historical Buddha. There is a verse in the Dhammapada that says just the same. Santuti paramang dhanang. Contentment is the greatest wealth. My devotion to the Dharma is my ornament. I deck myself with retaining mindfulness. We adorn whatever we value or love, whether it is ourselves or someone else or the three jewels. Milarepa prefers to adorn his breast only with the devotion of his heart to the Dharma. If he does wear any kind of decoration, it is what he calls retaining mindfulness, by which he means the recollection of meditative experience, especially dhyana, through his daily life. Milarepa is saying that by virtue of his spiritual attainments, he has all the wealth in the world at his disposal. As a continuous stream of positive mental events, the spiritual qualities over which he has attained mastery are inexhaustible. They can never be taken away from him by circumstances. Material poverty consequently holds no fear for him. The wealth he values is not material. In fact, it springs from a renunciation of material wealth. His wealth is the Dharma, or more specifically, the Dharma as expounded by his teachers. And this, of course, is very much the focus of the Kagyu tradition, the whispered lineage. The lineage is whispered in the sense of being taught confidentially, that is to say, not in books or public talks, but in a very personal exchange. Other factors being equal, the greater the number of people one is speaking to, the more generalized, even approximate, is the teaching. When someone gives a teaching to many people at the same time, it is up to each listener to decide for themselves how it applies to them individually, which makes it much more difficult for genuine transformation to occur. The smaller the number of people, the more specific, and therefore, in a sense, the more true the teaching can be. Even if you are addressing just two people, you have to direct what you say to what is common in them both, rather than what is individual and unique in each of them. The best situation for spiritual teaching is thus one-to-one communication, when what is truly individual in you makes contact with what is truly individual in the other person. When a guru does speak to just one person, he doesn't have to say much. One sentence may do. You can cut straight through all the general theory, the broad principles, and the full range of teachings designed to meet the needs of any conceivable kind of individual. In the tantric tradition generally, and in the Kagyu lineage in particular, it is usually said that any guru will find only a few disciples to whom he can communicate the teaching. In Milarepa's case, these are the 8 heart disciples. Each of them receives his own unique transmission of the Dharma, which is not necessarily a conceptual or verbalized teaching. The Zen tradition has a similar kind of transmission. It is this individual, unique teaching, whispered into the ear of one person at a time, which makes the greatest impact. Undeterred by Milarepa's refusal of his gifts, the young man now takes a new tack. It is natural for a supreme being like you not to want these illusory possessions. I now offer you my 3 companions. From now on, I will never carry a weapon or kill sentient beings. I beg you to grant me the ordination. I pray you to protect me with your compassionate grace. As this offering makes especially clear, every time Milarepa turns him down, the young man offers something more and puts more of himself at stake. To begin with, he was simply anxious to be saved from hell. Then he asked for Milarepa's compassionate blessing. Then he requested the teaching. And with this offering comes a glimmering of something not hinted at before. He realizes that the worldliness of his way of life is standing in the way of a deeper meeting with his teacher. He is no longer going to try to offer Milarepa material possessions in some expectation that he is going to find a use for them. Having acknowledged that the gifts he offers have no value for the cotton-clad yogi, he now takes a huge step forward. A far more profound ideal has begun to reveal itself to him, and he is ready to reorganize his life in order to attain it. He is beginning, in other words, to take responsibility for his own spiritual life, a decision marked by his asking for ordination, presumably lay ordination as an upasaka. Having done so, the youth throws himself under Milarepa's care, asking for the protection of his compassionate grace. The concept of grace appears quite frequently in the songs of Milarepa. The Tibetan term is cheno or chinlap, which in his translation of Tibet's great yogi Milarepa, Lama Kazi Dawa Sundup, renders as grace waves. The Pali term is anubhava, anu meaning after, and bhava meaning being or becoming. It's rather like an echo. Somebody's in a certain state of mind, a certain mood, and an echo or reflection of that mood is produced in somebody else. It is a traditional Buddhist belief that all those of high spiritual attainment emit this kind of influence. Of course, there is nothing special or exceptional about having an influence or impact on others. All living beings emit an unseen and often unnoticed influence. We all generate an aura of some kind with varying degrees of power. But what is being spoken of here as grace is something exceptional. the more deeply your insight has penetrated, the more positive and powerful becomes your aura or influence. And in the case of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, it is without limit. They are always sending out these grace waves, and we just have to open ourselves to them. Contrary to popular belief, the strictly Buddhist understanding is that this Anubhava does not offer material protection from material misfortune. It's quite easy to slip into talking about the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas protecting beings in a literal sense, particularly in the context of popular Buddhism. But such notions are not in accordance with all aspects of the tradition. Some would say that you are helped, supported, and even protected by grace waves, only in the sense that being more open to positive influences puts you in a more positive frame of mind, psychologically and spiritually. It is this that enables you to make progress. Exactly what the young man means by asking for protection, we have no way of knowing. Perhaps he isn't quite sure himself. Perhaps he is not clear in his own mind whether he is asking for mundane or spiritual protection, or some combination of the two. What we may be sure of is that in renouncing the physical protection of his weapons for the spiritual protection of the guru, he is taking a huge step forward, especially given the time and place in which he lives. His weapons are part of his identity, hence his name for them, the Three Companions. They never leave his side, for without them he will feel powerless to respond to attack. Medieval Tibet was a dangerous place with very little law and certainly no police to enforce it, and much depended upon your ability to defend yourself. In trying to picture this young warrior and his attitude to life, I am again reminded of my Kamba student in Kalimpong. Kamba men are very distinctive, even among other Tibetans. There's something decidedly swashbuckling about them, with their big boots and cowboy hats, their swords tucked in their belts, and their jacket sleeves nonchalantly knotted around their waists. Looking at Kamba mule drivers swaggering down the street in Kalimpong, you would think they owned the place, and people thought it best to get out of their way. I remember on one occasion going into a bank, a place of sober composure, even in India, and finding one of these Tibetans stretched out asleep on the floor. No one had dared to ask him to get up and move along. That would have been asking for trouble. The Kambas' fondness for a good fight also influenced their choice of entertainment. Kalimpong had its own cinema, and you could count on a full house when the programme featured a Western. Romantic films were just so much silly nonsense as far as the Kambas were concerned. But a cowboy film was a different matter, and the more shootings, fist fights, and mayhem, the better they liked it. In short, they are a proud and defiant people, and a good deal less sophisticated than the city dwellers of Lhasa, who tend to look down on them as rather barbaric and bellicose. But their bravery is legendary. The Kambas were the last Tibetans to surrender to the Chinese, continuing to harry them in guerrilla raids from the mountains, even after the invaders had taken over the country. At the same time, the Kambas are very religious, and in the early days of the invasion, when they used to ambush caravans, they were careful to avoid robbing those of Buddhist lamas. My Kamba student once told me a story that epitomizes the attitude of the Kamba warriors. It happened that a caravan belonging to one of the larger and more prestigious monasteries was passing through the land. It belonged to a Tulku, an incarnate lama, for whom the Kamba are known to have tremendous respect. The usual custom with Tibetan caravans is for the leading horse to wear a special decoration, usually a red plume on its forehead, and to be trained not to allow any other horse or mule to get ahead of it. a caravan belonging to an incarnate lama would be made instantly recognizable by a distinctive variation of this form of decoration. However, in this case, the manager of one of the big monasteries had decided that the leading horse should not wear its special insignia so as not to advertise the caravan as being in any way unusual. If people knew that it belonged to an incarnate lama, the manager thought, it would be more likely to be attacked and robbed of the precious goods it could be expected to be carrying. Unfortunately, this stratagem had the opposite effect of that intended. The Kamba men saw the unmarked caravan approaching in the distance and, considering it fair game, ambushed it and even killed a number of people in the process. When the guerrillas discovered in the course of their looting that it belonged to an incarnate lama, they were mortified and gave back all they had taken and begged the manager to convey their deepest apologies to the lama. They wished they could have restored the lives of those they had killed, but as for that, they said it was the manager's fault for disguising the caravan. This is very much the style and spirit of the Kambas, and we can be sure that the young nobleman whom Milarepa meets in the meeting at Silver Spring is more than a little like them. For him, life would have been a simple matter of protecting himself from real enemies who were in a position to do real and perhaps murderous harm. Your weapons and your willingness to use them would have had an important part to play in your protection by instilling fear into others. With his weapons, the youth says, I was a ruthless bandit. In giving up his weapons, the youth places himself under the protection of spiritual rather than material power. He surrenders them because they are the means of taking care of his interests through violence, through breaking the precepts. So he is moving from the practice of dana, generosity, the first of the six perfections of the Bodhisattva path, to the practice of sila, or morality, the second perfection. Having offered more and more of his possessions until he had nothing left to give, he is now ready to sacrifice his whole way of life insofar as it breaks the ethical precepts. He is ready to commit himself to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and as part of this process, he has to think about how he lives his life and make the changes necessary to bring it into line with the ethical ideals of the Dharma. So the meeting at Silver Spring has started to bite. He is beginning to think seriously about what being a disciple really entails. Now, will Milarepa be satisfied? No, is the answer. Milarepa is still unmoved, refusing to believe that the youth can keep his vow. He knows full well that there is a world of difference between intending to follow the ethical precepts and being able to put your noble aspirations into practice, especially when the going gets tough. Milarepa, he who does not renounce the all-important combat will be imprisoned and lose his chance for freedom. Battles and armies are not for the yogi. All important is in quotation marks here, to signify that it refers to something that is accorded huge significance by a social convention and popular assumptions, but which just little thought will reveal to be fairly trivial. For the young man, as for most males of any social standing in pre-industrial cultures, the all-important thing is combat. It used to be the same in Europe. To be a man of honour, or in England, a gentleman, involved being prepared to defend their honour when it was impugned. It may seem obviously absurd to have to wage your life on a duel because someone has insulted you, but it was all important at the time. Similar values persist in any culture where violence and aggressive competition prevail, such as urban gang culture. Membership of the group involves being prepared to defend the honour of being a member. In giving up his willingness to fight, the youth is giving up his allegiance to the collective values of his group. This is why his gift of weaponry represents a far more significant gesture than most of us can imagine. In the industrial age, respectability became all important. Today, high status within one or another social grouping is dependent on a variety of signifiers that can be gathered under the general heading of success, usually linked to material prosperity. Today, the false value that imprisons us is the importance we give to being a successful person by whatever criteria we judge success. Milarepa. The world without is my quiver. The non-clinging self-illumination within is my sheath of leopard skin. My weapon is the sword of great wisdom. The two-in-one path is my rope. My thumb guard is the merit of meditation. The two-in-one path is that of wisdom and compassion. The path of compassion, or skillful means, is pursued within the sphere of external activity among other living beings in samsara. The path of wisdom, on the other hand, is followed, in a sense, in the world within. But there is no real distinction to be made between external and internal, mundane and transcendental, samsara and nirvana. To follow the two-in-one path is to integrate the outer world and the non-clinging self-illumination within. Seeing them as one, seeing samsara and nirvana as perfectly interwoven in a living vision of non-duality. The two-in-one path is the path of the Mahayana, which sees the non-duality of form and emptiness, rupa and shunyata. Milarepa. Upon the bowstring of ultimate unborn voidness, I set steady the notch of Bodhi heart. I shoot the arrow of the four infinities at the army of the five poisons. In Mahayana and Vajrayana Buddhism, enlightenment is inseparable from the heartfelt desire to rescue all beings from the sufferings of samsara. This is the Bodhi heart, the bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment for the sake of all beings, which is the main spiritual faculty to be cultivated by the Mahayanist. Withdrawal from the mundane, accompanied by the arising of the bodhicitta, produces enlightenment. The traditional conclusion to any Mahayana practice is therefore to transfer any merit accruing to oneself through that practice to benefit all beings. Of course, in doing so, one makes it possible for the practice to contribute to one's own liberation. As for the ultimate unborn voidness, this is the goal of enlightenment itself. So why is it the bowstring and not the target? Well, as the verse reminds us, the ultimate voidness is unborn. As absolute reality, it is outside time, so it does not exist as a target in space and time. Nor should we forget that an arrow is a lethal weapon, and that one aims an arrow to destroy a target. It is therefore more appropriate that the target should be something we do seek to destroy through our spiritual practice, the army of the five poisons. The four infinities of the arrow with which the poisons are to be pierced and brought down are the four meditation practices called the Brahma-viharas, or the illimitables, or the divine abidings. As this verse tells us, they are steadied and powered by the connection with ultimate reality through the bodhicitta. The Brahma-viharas are metta, or universal friendliness, karuna, or compassion, mudita, or sympathetic joy, and upekkha, or equanimity. The five poisons are usually listed as craving, hatred, pride or conceit, ignorance, and distraction, though sometimes jealousy is substituted for distraction. These are our states of mind most of the time. greed, resentment, vanity, envy, and shallowness are like an occupying army, attacking our peace and happiness minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day. Without taking the imagery too literally, it is perhaps noteworthy that while usually each Brahmavihara meditation is meant to target one poison in particular, they are here directed collectively at the poisons together. That is, the positive emotions are seen as different aspects of essentially one and the same emotional attitude or direction, just as the poisons are seen as inextricably tangled up in each other. The song is unequivocally martial in tone and intent. Milarepa is saying, be a warrior by all means, but use your warrior's strength to fight the inner spiritual battle. In this way, he is trying to transpose the young man's energies, martial as they are, and thus, in a sense, the tough young man himself, from the worldly plane to the spiritual plane. He wants to make him a spiritual warrior. A battle is a telling and perennial metaphor for the spiritual life, suggesting an intensity of focus, a sense of something all-important at stake, and the need to make a choice between values that are set in eternal opposition to one another. It is a familiar enough in the Christian tradition, of course. One thinks of hymns like Onward Christian Soldiers and Blake's Jerusalem as follows. Bring me my bow of burning gold, bring me my arrows of desire. Bring me my spear, oh, clouds unfold, bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem. The tradition of the warrior persists in other ways too. Even today, the aristocratic ideal of the medieval knight, or the samurai warrior, is a potent one, with its challenges to honour that are not to be refused, and its tests of courage and generosity, loyalty and purity. For all its unequivocal commitment to the principle of causing no harm to living beings, Buddhism also makes use of military metaphors and images to denote the heroic, warrior-like spirit that is a vital spiritual quality. Weapons of one kind or another are wielded by bodhisattvas to signify certain transcendental qualities. For example, Manjugosha, the bodhisattva of wisdom, wields in his right hand a sword with which he is said to cut through ignorance. The military metaphor has its dangers, most obviously in the tendency to turn an inward and spiritual struggle to realise one's highest ideals into a conflict with external forces that are seen to oppose those ideals. However appropriate or otherwise it may be to engage in some kind of external conflict, this should not be confused with the real spiritual struggle which takes place within. The military analogy also suggests a high price will be paid for failure or defeat, but this does not apply to the spiritual battle. Those who do not commit themselves to the struggle cannot be said to have been defeated, while those who do so are guaranteed to triumph. As Milarepa sings in conclusion, there is no doubt I shall win the battle. Another risk associated with the idea of the spiritual warrior is that you become too ascetic and, under the pretext of fighting the good fight, force the pace of your practice, allaying your neurotic guilt by punishing yourself. And there is an even greater risk of being too hard on other people, of expressing hatred and ill will, under the pretext of encouraging others to take on the heroic ideal. In view of this, it is especially significant that the practices mentioned in this context are those specifically concerned with the cultivation of positive emotion, of kindness towards all that lives, including oneself. that battles and armies are perennially fascinating and awe-inspiring, even for monks, is illustrated by the presence in the Vinaya, the rules of monastic conduct, of a rule prohibiting bhikkhus from, quote, looking at armies, unquote. As Milarepa says, battles and armies are not for the yogi. Even today, people can develop quite an unhealthy interest in the progress of war as it unfolds in the news. But the energy of that interest can be harnessed in the service of the very different kind of battle that is the spiritual life. The combative approach to the spiritual life is, of course, by no means the only way to describe the Buddhist path. It is not a literal description of the spiritual life, but a metaphor, and another metaphor will do just as well, especially if it holds more appeal. Instead of the ideal of the knight errant, you may just as fruitfully be inspired by the ideal of the gardener or the healer, say, not destroying the poisons, but nurturing positive qualities or alleviating suffering, engaging in a cooperative process rather than a counteractive one. If the warrior is basically a masculine ideal, the complementary ideal is more feminine, receptive and cooperative, rather than confrontational. You might even be inspired by a childlike ideal of innocence and openness, like that exemplified by the much-loved Japanese poet Ryokan. Or you might prefer the image of the flower, imagining yourself growing in a garden, opening your leaves and blossoming in stillness and silence, just unfolding your petals, sending forth your perfume, and gazing up at the face of the sun. Again, there are well-known Christian references to such models. One thinks of Mary, the handmaid of the Lord, and Jesus' tribute to the lilies of the field. In taking inspiration from these metaphors, you're not thinking in terms of acting like a warrior, or a gardener, or a flower. Your aim is to transpose mundane qualities into spiritual ones, seeking to be a spiritual warrior, a spiritual healer, a spiritual flower, a spiritual handmaid, a spiritual gardener. However effective the healer, however beautiful the flower, however innocent the child, and however nurturing the gardener, such an ideal is a model of the spiritual life, not the spiritual life itself. By the same token, calling one ideal masculine and another feminine is not to say that, as spiritual ideals, these have anything to do with how masculine or feminine you are in the ordinary sense. Warriors may almost always be men, but spiritual warriors can be of either sex, and so can spiritual flowers, and even spiritual handmaids. As so often in the spiritual life, one has to be very careful not to be literalistic. We may say that the warrior ideal represents virya, energy in pursuit of the good, while the flower represents the opposite or complementary spiritual faculty, samadhi, in other words, meditation and contemplation. As so often in the spiritual life, there is a paradox here. Milarepa speaks to the young man's real interests in order to harness and transform the energy engaged with them, and the effect should be to internalize the young man's combativeness, to turn it against itself so that he is fighting his own aggression. The effect of the warrior ideal on this young man will thus be to turn him into more of a spiritual flower. The warrior type of person needs to be encouraged to sit still, to be quiet and patient, to be a warrior in meditation. He or she will still be intensely active, but in an entirely different way. Conversely, if you are inspired by the ideal of nurturing or healing or blossoming, you have to be encouraged to internalize these qualities so that they express themselves with the vigor and heroism that real growth requires. The opposite way of looking at these ideals can also work. If you tend to be slack and sluggish, you might still be able to find inspiration in the warrior ideal, while if you are a restless, aggressive type, you may be able to cultivate a yearning to be more contemplative, to be a spiritual flower. Either way, it is important that we do not simply carry our ordinary habits over into the spiritual life. And for this, the warrior ideal is always needed, at the service of, or in the context of, the ideal of the flower.